Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, for months now, hundreds and then thousands of Indigenous people have been taking part in peaceful protests at the Sacred Stones camp in North Dakota. They're protesting the construction of what's called the Dakota Access Pipeline, slated to carry fracked oil across the state and across the Missouri River. The Standing Rock Sioux say the Army Corps of Engineers approved the pipeline without their consent. For many people, what's happening right now in North Dakota is a crucial story of a frontline fight of Indigenous people against extractive industry, and on behalf of humanity, really, and the planet. So far, though, for corporate media, it's not much of a story at all. As we record the show, none of the big three TV networks have so much as mentioned it. We'll hear about the pipeline protests from Candy Mossett. Candy Mossett is Native Energy and Climate Campaign Organizer with the Indigenous Environmental Network. She'll join us from the Sacred Stones Camp to talk about this evolving, undercovered story. First, as usual, we'll take a quick look back at recent press. After weeks of watching media rehash Clinton and Trump campaign talking points of the day, Americans can be forgiven for wanting to see some ideas injected into coverage of the presidential election. For some people, debates are a natural opportunity to possibly pull candidates off script, force them to answer questions they didn't write themselves. But, activists are saying, debates that include only the two major party candidates are far less likely to do that. As FAIR founder Jeff Cohen notes in a recent column, the Commission for Presidential Debates that runs the show, though sometimes mistakenly described as nonpartisan, is in fact vehemently bipartisan, really a sort of corporation run by the two major parties and funded by powerful interests like oil and gas, pharmaceuticals, and finance. CPD rules, Cohen says, don't aim so much at eliminating non-viable candidates as at preventing outsiders from ever becoming viable. In charge of the debate since the 1980s, the CPD makes no bones about their intent to use their role to secure a Republican-Democrat duopoly. So much so that when they took over fully in 1988, the League of Women Voters, which had been running debates, pulled its sponsorship, saying the demands of the two campaign organizations would perpetrate a fraud on the American voter. Describing the deal that party chairs Frank Fahrenkopf and Paul Kirk had worked out as a closed-door masterpiece, League President Nancy Newman said, quote, "It has become clear to us that the candidates' organizations aim to add debates to their list of campaign trail charades, devoid of substance, spontaneity, and honest answers to tough questions. The League has no intention of becoming an accessory to the hoodwinking of the American public," close quote. Contrast that statement with that of Paul Kirk, now CPD Chairman Emeritus. Asked about broadening debates beyond the two major party candidates, even to the Green Party's Jill Stein and Libertarian Gary Johnson, who will be on the ballot in nearly every state, Kirk scoffed, quote, "It's a matter of entertainment versus the serious question of who you would prefer to be president of the United States," close quote. Just recently, the commission announced that the threshold for inclusion is based on public opinion. That's to say, public opinion polls. Candidates must get 15% in polls conducted by five national organizations that the group names. But there again, as journalist and activist Sam Husseini pointed out, the polls themselves have a way of tamping down interest in independent and third-party candidates. The question they ask is generally some variant of, if the election were held today, for whom would you vote? Which is subtly but importantly different from asking people open-endedly who they want to be president. As it is, these polls sort of replicate the bind the voter is already in, especially at a time when record-high numbers of people call themselves independents, and in a race in which many voters' main reason for supporting one major party candidate is that they are not the other. Of course, debates are only as enlightening as the questions, and the follow-ups to those questions, from moderators. And who will those be? That, too, is for the CPD to decide. An August 24th op-ed in the Washington Post from Fusion's Alexis Madrigal and Dodi Stewart notes that in 2012, all four moderators were white people over 55. And that just isn't what America looks like. Young adults between 18 and 33 are the most racially diverse generation in American history, they write. 43% are non-white. Large numbers date outside their race. They believe in a gender spectrum. About 68% believe government should provide health care for all. But young people are less likely to vote. Quote, could it be because they don't see themselves as important to the electoral process? Could it be because they're not included in the important conversations? Close quote. Well, opening up presidential debates is by no means a solution to an electoral process that leaves many people feeling frustrated and voiceless. Keeping those debates narrow and insular and then pretending they reflect public concerns is, however, most certainly part of the problem. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. For months now, the Standing Rock Sioux in North Dakota have been engaged in peaceful protest over the construction of the Dakota Access Pipeline, intended to carry fracked oil from the Bakken fields more than 1,000 miles into Illinois. The pipeline would, among other concerns, cross and recross the Missouri River that serves as a life source for the Standing Rock and others in the region. The protests have drawn solidarity from indigenous people around the country and some repression from state authorities, including the call by North Dakota's Homeland Security Director to remove water tanks and trailers from protesters' campsite, and Governor Jack Dalrymple's issuance of an emergency declaration to free up state resources to, in the words of the Bismarck Tribune, quote, manage public safety risks associated with the protest, close quote. Well, despite the significance of thousands of indigenous people standing up directly to extractive industry, events have till now played out largely under big media's radar, with social, independent, and especially native media doing the main work of getting the story out. Joining us now with more is Candy Mossett, Native Energy and Climate Campaign Organizer with the Indigenous Environmental Network. She joins us now by phone from North Dakota. Welcome to Counterspin, Candy Mossett.
Thank you. It's really a pleasure to be here with you today.
Well, as we record this show on August 25th, as far as I can tell, none of the three major TV networks has said a word about these protests over the Dakota Access Pipeline. So those who are relying on television anyway for news will likely know nothing at all about it. I would like to ask you then to give us a sense of what this struggle is really about and why it's drawn so much attention within and to some extent beyond indigenous communities.
Well, I think it's important to understand where we are here in North Dakota. It has a history of being a fossil fuel state. I grew up here in North Dakota. I was born, raised here. My family majority lives here. And I sort of had to work my way through how we were different or set apart from other areas. We had a lot of people in this state that had a lot of sicknesses and illnesses, particularly in my family, particularly on my reservation, which is just northwest of here, known today by the government as the Fort Berthold Reservation, but known by us as the Mandan, Hidatsa, and Arikara Nations. We're surrounded by 7 coal-fired power plants, the country's only coal gasification plant. Every single bit of the over 11,000 miles of rivers, lakes, and streams that are in North Dakota are already contaminated with mercury contamination because of the coal industry here. So that history already exists. And then we have fracking, which started in 2007, 2008, and we started seeing so much development taking place, and that's how, you know, we learned about the Dakota Access Pipeline, and they wanted to come through North Dakota and start here. And we had just been fresh, myself working with the Indigenous Environmental Network, just fresh off of fighting against the Keystone XL Pipeline, which many people are calling this Keystone XL Part 2, because it's still another way to move and transport oil, although now it's Bakken oil, which is being dug out directly under my feet at my homelands, and I'm seeing the devastation. So I think the media has always had a blackout from the bad things around energy development and around oil industry or gas or coal or anything to do with fossil fuels, because they feel like it's a good thing for our state because it provides jobs is what the main headline is. What they don't tell people in the large-scale media is that North Dakota does have a low unemployment rate. Yes, we always have. You can look back to statistics before even this Bakken oil boom, and we've had a 3 or 4% unemployment rate in our state, which is the same today. And so it's politicians here protecting the work that they know. I think that they don't know any better. It's business as usual. And because this infrastructure is already set up for fossil fuel development, they don't want the rest of the country to know and understand the struggles and the suffering that those of us on the ground have faced on a day-to-day basis. I'm getting emotional.
Yeah.
I am a cancer survivor. And there are so many around me that are fighting and struggling with it now, and I truly believe that the health of our people is impacted directly by the fossil fuel development, and it's frustrating that the media is not telling the truth about what's happening here. The truth being, we are peaceful protectors of water and of health, and we want our future generations to not have to deal with the cancers and the asthmas and the problems we've been facing here in this state, and also to let the rest of the country know that what happens in North Dakota does not stay here. The water, the Missouri River, flows downstream all the way down to the Gulf of Mexico, you know, all the way down through to the oceans, and the toxins, the pollutions, the dioxins, the carcinogenic poisons, the cancer-causing poisons that are being put in our water flow downstream. And this air that we breathe blows through the rest of the world, and we do not want that to be our legacy as concerned community members and people that live here.
Well, the Sacred Stones camp seems focused very much on a response to that broader and ongoing historical environmental context, but on an interruption of that business as usual, on saying we want to say no and call attention to our saying no to this. And I think that's why it's so galvanizing and exciting for people. And I wonder if you could tell us, many people may not know that this is, as you say, a peaceful protest, a prayer protest, and it was begun, wasn't it, by women. Women have a central role here.
Women do have a central role. That's not to say that men don't have a role as well. There were ceremonies that were led by four leaders that were actually men that went into ceremony, but through the support of the women. The actual blockade itself, some of the things that people may have seen where when the field was stormed by a group of women, it started with one woman that went out and took the field on the West Bank where they were trying to build a road to bring in the heavy equipment, which would help pull the pipe under the water for boring. So when they bore, they go underneath the ground instead of trenching and laying a pipe directly on top of the water, on the waterbed. So that's how the industry and how our state officials that signed off on this project make themselves feel better, is that they say they're being environmentally responsible by boring, but they still have to build all these roads. They still have to bring in all this equipment, and that pipe can still leak. The problem is that it'll be 90 feet below ground, so you won't detect the leak as immediately. So it's really kind of interesting in that regard, but women stormed the field and went out. The workers didn't know what to do. They just stopped their equipment. They were like, okay, hold on, and shut down and walked away, and they were like, okay, go ahead, jump up there. And that effectively is what's stop the work, because there hasn't been this level of pushback in North Dakota, I don't think, ever before. I mean, our tribes, the Menda and Hidatsa, the Rikara Nations, and certainly the Standing Rock Sioux fought back against the building of the dams that created our reservoirs here. Lake Sakakawea and Lake Oahe are reservoirs that are man-made that were created by a dam, and that was in the 50s, late 40s. We fought back then, but not to this extent where so many people came and stood with us, because we lost that battle. And now here we are trying to protect what was, we were forced into having a reservoir to get our water supplies from. And now they're threatening those reservoirs with this pipeline.
Right. Well, I hear a quiet voice in the background there.
I do have my 3-year-old here with me at the camp, and I have to say something that if I thought it was a violent place, I wouldn't have her with me. And there are also other children out here as well.
That's an excellent point, because a lot of what coverage I have seen has focused on conflict, has focused on violence. And to the extent that they talk about the concerns get a phrase, which is the indigenous people or the Standing Rock are concerned that a leak in the pipeline will pollute their drinking water. Well, I would say, first of all, leaks are not fears, really. I mean, look at history. They are near certainty, you know, pipeline leaks. But also, it's important to say that it is not just the fear of a leak that is the concern here. There are other concerns as well, aren't there?
There are many, many, many concerns. And they have to do with spirituality, too. I mean, that's why we come here in prayer. Everything is impacted, not just what a person might see on the surface. It's not just the water, and it's not just us as human beings. It's everything that relies on that water, the four-legged, the winged, everything that swims in those waters is impacted, yet doesn't have a voice to say, no, protect us, we don't want this either. It's all of the processes that go into getting that pipe there in the first place, and then that pipe isn't just here, it's through several states, in fact. In the big picture, the long term, what that's doing is it's saying that it's okay to continue business as usual when we know that our planet is in climate chaos because of anthropogenic causes, human-induced causes of messing with our Earth systems and our Earth cycles. We burn these oils and these fossil fuels and we put them into the atmosphere, never knowing the full impact of what it's going to do. Well, I should correct myself. We didn't know before, maybe at the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, but we certainly know now. We know that ethane and methane are causing warming temperatures, which are causing people to be displaced in the island states, in the Philippines. People are being displaced right now. We have all of these storms that are occurring, these hurricanes and flooding in Louisiana, where my friend Sharif Hoytland down there is fighting to say another Gulf is possible, yet she's cleaning the walls out of her home, cutting the walls out so they don't get mold because they were flooded. There's fires in California that are burning everything. There's intense heat in the Northeast. These are related. All of this is not a coincidence, and it's kind of taking a step back and looking at the big picture and seeing that this is not just a fight about this one pipeline. This is a fight to protect our planet for all of us as humanity.
When it comes to the treatment of indigenous people, those conflicts are treated, I believe, as historical. And there was a statement that came from the elders and leaders of the Sacred Stones camp that very smartly critiqued a New York Times article that talked about Indians in paint on horseback and their teepee-dotted camp. And they called it out, basically, as an effort to paint this struggle as somehow Native people having a romantic or a delusional desire to turn back time, instead of it being about a living community that is protesting present-day harms and also is concerned about the future. It seems to me that media coverage of Native peoples in general is kind of frozen in a very old framework that has nothing really to do with living Native people today.
Yeah, and I would agree with that. I mean, that doesn't surprise me either. That is how historically we've been treated, as some romanticized version of something you read about the historical things that happened to Native people. And it makes for a good story for a reporter or a journalist when you talk about, you know, oh, the Wild West and these Natives. And what's interesting is that we are all separate nations that have come together. And not all of us were horse people. Not all of us were teepee people. Here we are on my traditional homelands, the Mandan, the Hiradza, the Arikara. These sacred sites where they're digging, these are Arikara traditional homelands. My ancestors' bones are buried in these sites, and we were Earth Lodge-dwelling people. Yet I don't see anything out there showing our true historical context. We did not live in teepees year-round. We didn't predominantly hunt the buffalo and move around. Our relatives, the Great Sioux Nation that we traded with, did these things while we were farming people. That's why we lived along the Missouri River, always for time immemorial. We grew corn, squash, and beans. This area that we're gathered is a historic trading center where we would all camp and come together so we could see each other. We could see our enemies and we could trade in a good way. That was something that happened a long time ago, Ma de Digoa, we say in Hiradza. But here today, we are gathered once again, traditional enemies coming together, all with our own different stories, our different ceremonies, but in a modern day way. We drove in with our cars, some of us. We're camping in our tents, many of us. Sure, there are a few teepees, but it's predominantly tents that you'll see out here. And it's not, oh, what happened to us historically as natives in this country. It's what's happening to us now. This is history that's being created, and people need to put it back into that context of, we never went anywhere. Sure, we were beaten down heavily. Sure, a lot of our people died, but we're still here. We never changed our story about the fight to protect our Mother Earth. We have been screaming for over 500 years. We have been screaming about the wrong associated with capitalism and continued growth and just taking and taking and taking and never giving anything back. We have been saying always, do not do these horrible, terrible things to the land and to our earth, because it will come back. It'll come back on us. And it is coming back on us now. It's just taking other people a very long time to open their eyes and see what we have been talking about all along, about respecting the sacred, respecting the water, respecting the air, respecting the soil. And it took people to start seeing the dangers and the harms and to start getting sick and to start realizing that we're in a bad way before they decided, oh, maybe we do need to stop. And yet still, oil industry people, gas industry, all of the corporations still do not see. They're still blinded by greed and the false power associated with money. If we turned on our tap and didn't have anything come out, what would we do? If we went into a grocery store and there was nothing on the shelves, what would a person do? Could you find water if your tap didn't turn on? Could you feed yourself if you didn't have a store to walk into? Some deep, deep, deep understandings are being made, I think, as a result of what we're doing here. And the reason we're praying is because of the power of the prayer. The reason we're peaceful is because we never wanted to be violent. Even in historical context, we were peaceful. None of that has changed. And so we speak for ourselves. We tell our story.
Well, let me just ask you finally, Candy Mossett, what happens now? I mean, there was a hearing yesterday. I understand that construction is being not going to be halted. What's going to happen next, do you think, in terms of the activism and the response?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like the camp is going to grow. The hearing did happen yesterday in Washington, D.C., and the decision was no decision. September 9th is going to be the next date for the hearing. And so we'll be ready, and we'll be in D.C. again. We'll be here at the camp preparing for what will happen, and we'll be prepared here at the camp if the Energy Transfer Partners and Dakota Access people should decide that they want to continue to try to build here. We will meet them again, as we did before, and be prepared to protect our water and be prepared to do what we have to do, which is nonviolent direct action, in order to protect that water for everybody. The power of visiting is, there's nothing that can take away the power of visiting. And it's a beautiful thing to see our relatives coming together in such large numbers, visiting over a campfire and eating some good food at camp and telling stories and laughing and seeing the babies running around and playing. And the intensity of the emotion here, it can't be described. It can't be described. And so if a person wants to know it, they should come here. They should come here to Standing Rock, to Cannonball, North Dakota, and join us in our struggle and our fight and set up a camp. Everybody is welcome. More information can be found at sacredstonecamp.org. We also have a Facebook page, No Dakota Access and Treaty Territory. It's an open page where people can go and see the ongoing list of supplies that we have that we need at the camp. If you cannot come here, you can donate. You know, there are definitely ways to help. There's a petition that people can sign on change.org/respectourwater, but respect is spelled with a Z, so change.org/respectourwater. And that petition, we're trying to get 1 million signatures on that. And we're calling on our president, President Obama, to take notice and to come out here and to see what we're talking about and to understand what we're trying to protect and to effectively halt the Dakota Access Pipeline.
We've been speaking with Candy Mossett, Native Energy and Climate Campaign Organizer with the Indigenous Environmental Network. The website again is sacredstonecamp.org, and the Facebook page is No Dakota Access in Treaty Territory. Thank you very much, Candy Mossett, for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Matsa Gerad, thank you.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find them on FAIR's website. It's fair.org. And the website's also the place to sign up for FAIR's Action Alert Network. The show is engineered by Erica Bassett. I'm Janine Jackson. Thank you for listening to Counterspin.